And happy to welcome back into the studio today a guest who's been with us a couple of times before from Congregation Beth Shalom and the Center for Thought and Culture. Niles Goldstein is with us. Niles, welcome back.
Good morning, Barry.
Good to have you.
Thanks.
So let's talk first of all about Passover. It's a very important week in all the major religions.
It is, yeah. I mean, what a lot of people don't know about Passover is that in the historical context, it was really one of the most important holidays in Jewish life. There were three pilgrimage festivals that involved people who lived all over the ancient Near East making pilgrimages to Jerusalem, just like today. Muslims travel from all over the world to go to Mecca. That all changed 2,000 years ago when the Romans destroyed the temple and Judaism took on a whole different shape. But it still remains one of the most popular of Jewish holidays, although it looks very different today than it did during the era of animal sacrifice and the priesthood and all of that.
Mm-hmm. One of those interesting thoughts to pursue about the commonalities between the major religions, and we end up spending so much of our treasure and blood fighting amongst each other when there was all this commonality at that origin point.
It's pretty amazing, especially when you look at the Abrahamic faith traditions. I mean, about a year ago, a year and a half ago, Passover and Easter were also really close, just like they are this year. And I did a teaching session with a local Lutheran pastor, Julie Webb, where we looked at the theme of rebirth. And the theme of rebirth is at the core of both the observance of Passover, the Exodus from Egypt, and the observance for Christians of Easter. So there really are quite a number of parallels, at least in the Abrahamic traditions.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Anything special at the temple for Passover?
Yeah, we are holding our annual Seder the second night. The first night falls on Friday. Most people observe the Seder at their homes or with friends. The second night at CBS, we have a big community Seder that I don't even know if there are any spaces left yet, but we're going to do a big celebration that I'm going to lead with our music director, Gordon Lustig.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually a really fun event for kids and seniors. And so we're anticipating a lot of fun that night.
Very good. So as we're saying, it's a big week in every religion or most all religions right now. And this fire at the Notre Dame was so shocking. And I know my first reaction was that it was connected somehow, that there was this was a heinous act because of the moment in the year that we're at and so forth, and the tensions that exist in Paris. But it's a kind of an event that has sort of broken down the walls between different groups of people. It feels like those moments when everybody kind of comes together and recognizes mm-hmm. something bigger than the current moment.
Yeah, I think that's right. Western Europe, France, Paris, is largely secular today. But you're right. There's something about Notre Dame that has really tugged at the heartstrings of Parisians and the French and a lot of people in Europe. When the fire started, I thought, it sounds like maybe you did too, that this might have been the result of terrorism. Mm-hmm. Here's this emblem of Western culture, Western civilization. It doesn't look like that's the case. But it's pretty interesting how within the context of a largely secular culture, this has really been a very traumatic moment. Within the last couple of days, they've raised, as of last count, $1 billion to rebuild it, which for me, and I was looking at my Facebook feed among colleagues of mine, Christian and not, that in of itself, I think, is worthy of conversation because it's sort of interesting that we can raise $1 billion within 2 days to reconstruct a building. But, even the largest profit organizations in the world can't raise that kind of money in 2 decades to feed the hungry and clothe the naked and help the homeless. And, it raises some interesting questions about what really motivates us.
Absolutely right.
And Barry, if I could just say one more thing, it's really interesting that even though we live in a largely secular world, at least in Western Europe and North America, religion still winds up, rearing its head and being at the heart and soul of a lot of what motivates us. And I don't think you can understand a lot of geopolitical situations without understanding religion, whether it's Europe or the Middle East or Myanmar or the Philippines or, you name it, Poland. you know, it's really important to understand religion, even if you're not a practicing religionist.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. And it's easy, like you say, in an increasingly secular world, to feel like you can take a sort of academic step back. Mm-hmm. You just look at facts, you look at policies and laws and whatnot, and you're missing something really significant.
If you're trying to figure out how to solve conflicts, if you're trying to understand, group mentality, culture, you know, it really is important to at least have a rudimentary understanding of religion.
Yeah. In connection to what you were saying about this ability to raise all this money for a building and all these other needs, one of the great needs in the present day is to address the worldwide refugee crisis. We're seeing a tiny piece of that with some of what's happening at the southern border, people who are refugees from Central America. But that's a fraction of this worldwide issue. And the event you have coming up at the Center for Thought and Culture in just a week or so is focused on that refugee issue. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, we are putting together a program called Frayed Lives. It'll be next Tuesday, April 23rd at 5:30 p.m. And the Napa Center for Thought and Culture, which is only a year old, I'm on the board. I'm one of our founding board members. Ellen Elson is our president. She's been really a driving force. We have done a lot of great programming for Napa and the greater Bay Area. And we wanted to do something that was also very topical and that was not just focused on culture and in the aesthetic sense. And because this is such a pressing issue, not just in the United States, but around the world, we put together a great panel of speakers from around the country who are going to talk about this issue and about what we can do to address it in a more thoughtful way, because it is a complex issue. I don't care whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or a Libertarian. It's a very complicated issue. And our keynote speaker is a guy named Mark Hetfield, who's a CEO of HIAS, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, which is one of the largest refugee resettlement organizations in the country. It started in the 19th century to resettle Jews who were coming over from Eastern Europe, but now they work with everybody. And so to get him to come to Napa is really a coup. And we encourage anyone who wants to come to sign up. They can just go to the website, nctcnapa.org. And come on Tuesday night.
Mm-hmm. Is there a cost for it?
Yeah, it's $30, mm-hmm. Either $30 or $35 per person, and it includes a meal. There will be a dinner at 5:30, and then at about 6, we'll get started with the program.
That's a bargain.
And it'll be interactive. After we hear from our speakers, mm-hmm. we're going to sit at tables, and board members are going to facilitate discussions. And, mm-hmm. you know, we really want people to leave the evening and the program with some concrete steps that they can take to try to help the situation.
Mm-hmm. So you have a panel in addition to your keynote?
Yeah, we have the keynote, followed by a panel of some other experts in the field, and followed by that will be these table discussions.
Mm-hmm. Is there a significant refugee issue in the Jewish community at this point? Because I'm asking in complete ignorance, because there are so many displaced populations in the world right now.
There are. It just depends on where you go, what part of the country, what congregation. But certainly there are a growing number of Jewish organizations and congregations that are really focused on, even on a small scale level, trying to help asylum seekers, refugees. We're exploring that here in Napa. Because even if you can help one family, a woman with a couple of kids, find a better life, you know, if they're fleeing from gangs or poverty or warfare, you know, you're doing something good for the world.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Let's talk for a moment, if we can, about some items that have been in the news. Israel's just gone through an election, for one thing. We've had, you know, declaration of sovereignty in the Golan Heights, if I recall, that our president endorsed. There's been a movement with Netanyahu to the hard line, the hard right in mm-hmm. Israel. How do Jews here in California interact with that? Is it important to members of your congregation?
Yeah, I think it's very important. But, you know, as with any community, there is a wide range of views among Jews in North America and Jews here in Napa about Israel. I think what is clear is that a lot of people, myself included, are a bit troubled by the Netanyahu government, the turn to the right in Israel, the nationalism that is rearing its head there, as it is here in the United States and in most places around the world, Brazil, the Philippines, Hungary. But I think where there still is widespread unanimity is in support for Israel as a Jewish state a state that needs the support of our country here and can really be one of its best friends in a pretty dangerous part of the world. So I'm a lifelong Zionist, but I'm not a big fan of the current government in Israel. And, you know, that's where there are some tensions in the diaspora-Israel relationship right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Part of the challenge for anyone who is critical of the policies of the current government in Israel or of any government in Israel is combining the feeling about a particular government or a political policy with the questions of anti-Semitic attitudes. Mm-hmm. And we've seen a classic example of that around the Muslim representative Ilhan Omar from Minnesota, mm-hmm. and some remarks that she's made that allowed her political opponents to brand her as anti-Semitic. Now, just looking at that one, you know, particular issue seemed a little bit distorted, but, you know, her track record is her track record. And, of course, she does come from a Muslim community, and there's a lot of complications to it. Regardless of her particular issue, the bigger question comes up is, do any of us have the ability to get away with, as it were, criticizing Israeli government policy without being called anti-Semitic?
Well, that's a good question, and Omar does represent some problematic aspects within the Democratic Party, and they're going to have to figure it out. But, you know, I would say that much of the criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism at its core, but not all of it. And a lot of people I know who are right-wing Zionists, and I know plenty of them here and around the country, you know, take a position of Israel right or wrong, and who are we to criticize them? And I don't adhere to that. I don't subscribe to that. I don't like that. I don't want to shut off my brain. I think there's a lot to criticize the Israeli government about, just like there's a lot to criticize the current American administration about. So I don't think that I have to turn off my brain and not criticize Israel when it makes mistakes. And I don't think that all criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism. However, I think a lot of it is. And I think a lot of times people who are highly critical of Israel, and that includes the United Nations, single Israel out for problematic policies and behavior when they look the other way in terms of other governments, Saudi Arabia, you know, any number of governments who are also doing things that are highly questionable in terms of humanitarian issues and rights, and they just kind of look the other way. So the fact that Israel tends to get singled out for special criticism, that's problematic to me. But I do think, you know, it's a nation state like many others, and it's fair game. I mean, if it does something wrong, it deserves to be called out on it.
It's fascinating to me time and time again when we talk about anti-Semitism and the many forms that it takes and the many conspiracy theories and the stories that are spun, that what is essentially a pretty small segment of the world's population, people of the Jewish faith, have been deemed to be responsible for so much. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It must be hard work being a Jew, I guess. That's what I'm saying. They have all these conspiracies to keep running all the time.
Yeah, I have to keep track of all these conspiracies. There's a new one every year, it seems.
What's the conspiracy meeting tonight? Where are we meeting?
Right. You know, it people write dissertations on this subject. It's true that anti-Semitism became worse with the advent of the Catholic Church and saw its culmination in many ways in the Holocaust in the 30s and 40s in Germany and in Europe. But if you study history, it's also true that anti-Semitism predates Christianity. You had Greek anti-Semitism, you had Roman anti-Semitism. There's something about the Jewish people, and I don't know why, that for other groups creates animosity, creates envy, creates something that sometimes can lead to really horrific outcomes. And I'm not the kind of person – I'm not reactionary. I'm not going to call anyone who offers criticism of Israel, you know, an anti-Semite. There are a lot of things about the Jewish community that I find problematic and that we need to work on, like any community. But anti-Semitism is real. It seems to be growing here and for sure in Europe. And that's something we need to address as a community and in the corridors of power in this country. I mean, look at what happened in Pittsburgh several months ago. Someone walked into a synagogue and killed 11 people praying, just like what happened in Christchurch in those two mosques. So if you have people and at the African-American church, I believe it was South Carolina a year or so ago. So if you have people who have so much hatred in their hearts who are willing to kill people at prayer or at study, you know, that's a real problem. And the fact that for so many centuries, Jews have been singled out in particular, you know, it's an intractable problem. And as I said, dissertations are written on it. And I certainly don't have the answer as to why Jews get singled out in the way that, you know, I wonder why Israel gets singled out for special criticism when so many other countries around the world are doing, you know, some very problematic things.
You know, I was thinking if we had a debate team, we could set up a resolved statement to argue about, even here in this very religious week that we're in the midst of. Would the world be better off, would we have less conflict if there never was religion, if there was no belief in higher powers and gods to begin with?
Well, I don't have the answer to that.
I'll give you 30 seconds.
Yeah, but what I would say in 30 seconds is that I think religion, on the one hand, can bring out the worst in people. There's no question about that. On the other hand, I think religion can bring out the best in people. And if you look at some of the great social justice movements in this country, the abolitionists, women's suffrage, labor rights, civil rights, they were all led by religious leaders. So, you know, religion is one of the oldest, maybe the oldest human institution. But, you know, it's got two poles. It can you know, really lead to some pretty terrible outcomes, but it can also help transform people's lives for the better, which is why I think people just need to be literate in the subject.
Niles Goldstein with us from Congregation Beth Shalom and from the Center for Thought and Culture. Tell us again where folks can go to find out more about that event on the 23rd.
Yeah, they can go to the website of the Napa Center for Thought and Culture. It's nctcnapa.org, and they can buy tickets right there.
Thank you for coming in today. It's always a real pleasure. It gets my brain really firing, all the synapses when we talk.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. Me too.
Okay. And that's about all we have time for right now.